Class of 89.
Bon appetit, bitch.
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 89 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turned 30 this year. I'm Natasha Pasetta, your host and vanguard of the vault over here at Fangoria, and this is the second installment of our three-part series on A Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child. Our guest today is screenwriter Les Boheem. Les talks about his early career in rock and roll and how that got him a gig writing movies, crafting the original Greta death sequence, the surreal moment when he watched Robert Englund deliver the Freddy lines that he wrote, and much more. We'll get to Les's stories in just a minute, but first, I want to tell you about Fangoria magazine. Fangoria was unleashed on the world in 1979, and after 40 years, Fango is still delivering the secrets, set visits, behind-the-scenes scoops that you've come to expect and grown to love. And now they're doing it in real style, with 100 glossy pages of collectible content featuring bylines like Barbara Crampton and S. Craig Zahler, and so much more. And it's all print only, so the magazines will never be available online ever. It's print only. You're going to have to open it up with your hands and read it. And it's exactly the analog experience that we wanted to revisit, because that's the experience that we loved when we were growing up with Fangoria. So if you haven't checked out the new issues of Fango, please do so. It's going to blow your mind. And head over to Fangoria.com to check it out for yourself and to subscribe. And you can use the promo code CLASSOF, that's CLASSOF, to get 15% off your first year of Fango. So go to Fangoria.com and click subscribe and use the promo code CLASSOF for your 15% off discount. And I want to tell you about the new game, The Sinking City. Dive into The Sinking City, an investigative adventure game set in an open world inspired by the universe of H.P. Lovecraft, the master of horror. The half-submerged city of Oakmont is gripped by supernatural forces, and you are a private investigator, and you have to uncover the truth behind what has possessed the city and the minds of its inhabitants. The Sinking City is available on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC. You can pre-order now at thesinkingcity.com for exclusive bonuses. Now let's get to Les Boheem's stories about working on The Dream Child. Well, you started your career in an interesting way. You actually started in rock and roll. And if anyone's ever seen Revenge of the Nerds, you have heard one of Les's songs. So how the heck did you make this crazy jump from music to screenwriting?
I'm going to tell you the somewhat long version, but my parents were both screenwriters. And so my idea of what grown-ups did when they went to work was they went in the other room and typed. But nepotism did nothing for me. My mother became a rare book dealer and a special collections librarian. And my father was long out of the business and cranky by the time I got interested. So instead, I dropped out of school and joined a rock and roll band. I was in one band after another. And by the time I was in my late 20s, I was in a couple of bands that were really popular in L.A. My own band, Gleaming Spires, which you mentioned had the song in Revenge of the Nerds. Are we avoiding saying, are you ready for the sex girl?
No, you can totally say it.
And then my day job was I was bass player in Spark, quite still to this day, a legendary band. I was lucky enough to play with them for about 5 years. And with Sparks, I was doing a European tour, and both the Spires song and the Sparks song were on the radio a lot in Los Angeles. And a good friend of mine who had been a drummer in my bands in college had become a producer. He was producing for Mel Brooks, and he had produced The Elephant Man and The Fly and a couple of other things. And he called me in Paris. That sounds so good. He called me in Paris, where the band was playing. And he said that there was a record company and a film company that had this idea about rock and roll, and he had told them that they should talk to me because I was in a band and I spoke in complete sentences. And so they flew me back from Paris, and it was Atlantic Records, which had never signed any of my bands, and a company at Warner Brothers that I didn't know anything about because I didn't know anything about the movie business. And I told them that their idea sucked, and I'd like to go back to Paris right away, and they hired me in the room.
Wow.
And It's that, you know, everybody says, oh, life's like high school dating. It's like the only time I've ever been able to pull that off. If I try to act snotty and arrogant now, people just think I'm snotty and arrogant. But
it worked out that one time.
I had just shaved my head for a Gleaming Spires video, so I looked really scary. And so they hired me, and for about 4 years, I wrote, you know, the junior executives all thought that I was cool because I was in a band they knew. And I was just starting out, so it wasn't very expensive to hire me. Although it was way more money than I'd ever made playing music right off the bat. I wound up having to buy all the drinks for the band on several tours. What would happen would be the junior executives would pay the small amount they had to write a script. And then, you know, this is the early 80s. Their bosses would look at it and go, well, there's no part for Kevin Costner or Mel Gibson, so we're not going to make this movie. So I lived in this sort of phantom world where, you know, it was Kafka land. I mean, I was making a good living and I wrote every day and nothing ever got made. And the only other job that anybody would consider someone from rock and roll for would be horror movies. Because, you know, in the minds of people who don't like either, they're closely associated.
They are.
And I remember being so scared by the first Nightmare movie that I literally asked the people I was with if anybody wanted popcorn because I wanted to walk into the lobby for a minute.
Wow.
You know, just like I was like, oh my God. I mean, I think the only other time I've been that scared was I saw The Exorcist the day it came out. And both times I was just like, oh my God, I'm in the hands of maniacs. there's no safety.
Quite the experience to see The Exorcist in the theater.
It was like, I mean, you know, that makes me old, but it was absolutely like you felt like there's no safety net. I'm in the hands of lunatics. There's just, well, obviously you see a movie, it's like being on a roller coaster ride. It's scary, but you know, you're going to come out of it safely.
Right.
Not in that case.
No.
And I was like, this is going to damage me severely. And the first Nightmare did the same thing to me. So as soon as I got an agent, you know, I had written a script early on that New Line almost made before they'd made any of the Nightmare movies. In sort of their post-John Waters, pre-Nightmare moment.
What was that?
And I was a sort of wannabe Clint Eastwood action movie. I was almost Peter Fonda for a minute. You know, this was really early on. This was probably right after I sold my first script. And so I knew some of the people there vaguely, and I just hammered on my agent all the time to get me a meeting because I had this brilliant idea for the third Nightmare on Elm Street. I think, you know, the second one had just come out. My brilliant idea was rip off Rosemary's Baby. Like, you know, Freddie should have a baby. And so my agent set me up a meeting and I went in, and the executive who I was pitching to was like 6 months pregnant. I was pitching stuff like, and then you see the little claws trying to make their way out.
Oh my gosh.
And that didn't go over well.
I'm sure it didn't. No.
No. And so that, but through that meeting, I wound up meeting Sean Cunningham. And so I wrote, it's actually my first produced credit is either House 3 or The Horror Show, depending on what country you see it in.
Oh, okay. So Nightmare 3 didn't go over very well, as we all know, it turned into Dream Warriors. And the producers of New Line revisited your Freddy baby story when it came to number 5. They actually like called you back to do something with number 5. What was that conversation?
I got a call and they said, we have this idea for the fifth Nightmare on Elm Street. We think Freddy should have a baby.
And, that was my idea,
I said,
guys.
I said, yeah, I mean, it's odd because I've had, you know, I've been doing this a long time. I've had people pitch me things that I pitched them.
Oh my God.
You know, and a couple of times, and usually I think there's sort of a sense memory. Like, you know, they get pitched so much stuff, they don't remember who pitched what, but
right.
Somehow some weird thing at the back of their brain goes, you know, here's this idea, Les Boheme. And the reason that it clicked is because they heard it from me first.
Right.
I don't think in this case that happened. I think it was I don't think anybody remembered. I mean, I literally said, you know, if you take notes and you check your file, you'll see that I once pitched you that same idea.
That was my original idea.
Yeah. And, you know, but I was thrilled, obviously. And so then I started writing it.
You thought you were working off of, you know, notes from New Line.
Oh, yeah. That's an unpleasant little moment. So,
yeah.
So I was working on this other story that was still Freddie has a baby, but it was a different story. And, you know, this is a movie that's going to start shooting on a given date. And, you know, there's release dates already. I mean, everything's, you know, hard and fast. And I turn in that script and they go, well, no, actually, we have this totally different idea. Mm. And, you know, what do you think of this? And I honestly don't remember if they handed me some pages that were, you know, came from an executive or if they just pitched the idea. It was cool. And I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, if you don't want A, let me try B.
Right.
I think, you know, Steve Hopkins came on board almost right away. So, you know, we were working towards the shooting script right from the start and they made the movie. And when a movie has a release date, if there's more than one writer involved, the Writers Guild, the studio proposes credit, and then the Writers Guild sends you the proposed credit. And so I get this thing, and and they'd already done posters. So
right, they did posters way before the movie was even shooting.
Right, and like the English poster, which is gorgeous, is, you know, it's just my name. And I get this thing, and there's Skip and Spector, you know, original story with me, because, you know, I'd changed a lot by then. So I was like, well, who, what? And they were like, oh, well, we have this outline from these guys. You know, they were really making a splash in the magazine world at that point. They were really good writers. And, you know, so I reached out to them and was like, I'm really sorry. I didn't know. And, you know, absolutely, your name should be on the story. And, you know, like, I wish somebody had told me so you didn't get, you know, you could have had a poster. It was, I admit, you know, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything malicious there. I think on you know, New Line's part, I think it's just an oversight, really.
Right,
I mean, because there was nothing to be gained by screwing those guys.
Right, right.
You know, I felt terrible because, I mean, you know, we all get hired to rewrite each other all the time. That's the nature of it. But usually, you know, you reach out to the other people you talked about. You know, you kind of, you know, it's not your fault,
right.
You know, and you know, it could also be a fight over money, and, you know, that's not fair either, because it was their story. They should pay for their story, obviously. So, you know, so it turns out I was adapting their story to some extent.
Let's talk about your original script. So, I mean, I'm sure the script is very different than what actually was shot and what we see now.
Sure.
Was the Freddy baby, was that an existing description, or did you kind of really flesh that out and make the Freddy baby what he was? What was your interpretation of the Freddy baby?
I think, and I haven't looked at my original script in, you know, 1989, but I think it was closer to the sort of, you don't ever see much except the little claw, you know, like it was a little closer to the Rosemary's Baby thing. But then when Steve and I started working on the shooting script, I don't know if you're talking to Steve Hopkins, but, you know, he was a comic book artist first. And so, yeah, and this was sort of before the, you know, everything in the world is a graphic novel now, but
right.
It was really interesting because we would work and he would just like sketch storyboards while we were working, you know, like I'd be writing it. He'd go, well, kind of like this, and hold up. It was really cool. I mean, I've never worked with anybody else that did that.
And it has that like graphic novel kind of feel to it. It definitely does. I think it's the most surreal out of the franchise, and it does have that. It does have that like gritty, dreamlike graphic novel feel to it for sure.
Was it? Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I was a couple of years after, somewhere in the mid '90s, I was doing a screenwriting conference in Austin, and I was like ridiculously on a panel with Wes and with Toby Hooper. It was like, well, I don't know what I'm doing here. It was a little out of my league.
I think anyone would feel out of
my league. But, you know, so I was talking to Wes and going like, I hope I didn't take liberties. And he's like, well, the thing is, like, we never had the rules down, you know, that it, you know, if you were writing Dracula, there's a rule book and you can't stray from that rule book. You know, if you start doing I was going to say, although I guess it is in the book, but, you know, like all of a sudden in the Coppola movie, when he could go outside in the middle in the day, they're like, wait a minute.
Wait.
I know my vampire lore. They can't go outside in the day. What are you talking about? You know, but the, sort of like okay, well, we know if you fall asleep, he can get you, but how he interacts with the real world, we've never quite, you know. It, so, right. And you know, it drove long after, you know, Wes wasn't doing them, and it drove New Line nuts. I mean, you know, they're just like, well, what are the rules? We're like, well, that it'd be really cool and scary.
Yeah. I think
that. So yeah, so we, like, I'm sure we stretched some of whatever that, you know, I mean, obviously the thing that made the first one so scary was you can't fall asleep. I mean, that's just a right. crazy great idea. You know, I mean, that's like, you know, three people have had a horror idea that good ever.
Right.
You know?
Which is
like, and I don't know who the other two are. Yeah.
That's right. There are no rules. There really aren't. And that's so funny that you actually, you know, talked to Wes about that. And that must have been such a weird moment for you to be like, I don't know what you thought about this, but
yeah. Cause yeah. It's like, you know, I mean, yes, there is the rule. You can't fall asleep.
Right.
People get you. But it, you know, that, I mean, that got harder and harder to maintain five
right.
in, you know, so, you know, you started inventing other stuff.
But the Freddy baby, that's such a genius move, because there are certain ways, like, you know, Freddy, one way is through your dreams, but like throwing a baby in there and getting in that way is just, it's
right.
just
well,
genius.
That was, I mean, that, you know, I mean, in my original pitch back at 3, it was, I guess I was sort of kicking at those rules. So I was like, he wants to be in the real world, and this is how he gets into the real world. That was kind of, in all the versions, even in that first Greek tragedy version, that was kind of, you know, the driving thing. I figured out how to not just get you in your sleep. And I thought it kind of like, you know, I was like, this will help your whole franchise, because now he's right. in, you know, now he's in the real world.
Right. It's like, there are other ways he can get in, guys. Like, Alice is always
yeah.
like, but I was awake. You're responsible for creating a new rule on how to get Freddy into the real world. What direction did you take the Freddy character himself in for this one? Because I really like how he is in 5. He's very in your face, down and dirty, well, jokester, you know? He's really
funny.
Fun.
I think, you know, there were a lot of people there who weren't particularly horror fans. They had just lucked into this incredible franchise that they couldn't quite figure out why.
Mm.
You know, like what they'd done. And then there was an executive there who's gone on to be, you know, a legend in our business, Mike DeLuca. And Mike loved this shit. And I remember Mike and I just sitting at one end of this huge boardroom. I've never been in a meeting like that. It looked like an advertising agency. There were like 30 people in the room. And they had this printed sheet of rules for Freddy. And it said things like, Freddy is the slasher David Letterman. There must be one wisecrack per killing.
Wow.
And, you know, and they were trying to figure everything out. They were being very analytical about it. I looked at Mike and I was like, Mike, are we the only guys here who like these movies? And he's like, yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, and so we were like, you know, and, but, you know, he was a powerful guy already. And he was like, just do whatever's cool, like that, you know. But in fact, they really, really love, you know, it was, I mean, if you think about it, it was the age of the wisecrack. I mean, we went from the great Clint Eastwood ones to the really crappy Arnold ones. There are some Schwarzenegger movies where the lines are so dumb. It's like, you're trying so hard to make my day, right? But, you know, but then there's Make My Day, which is, you know, like unbelievably cool.
Right.
And, you know, so it was the age of that. And, you know, and right from the beginning, I mean, Freddy had that, you know, that, you know, I mean, Jason didn't talk.
Right. Right. Freddy has personality. Always has.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and so like that was just fun. I mean, I was like, I mean, really two of the most fun things I've ever gotten to do were write Freddy, because he was already an utterly established character. And I wrote a Western for television once. So the first time that I typed interior saloon, I was so happy. I just, oh my God, I wrote interior saloon.
That is pretty cool.
It was. I just stopped and looked at the page. It's like, look at that, interior saloon.
What would you say is your favorite line that you wrote for Freddy? Do you have a favorite?
I don't know that I have a favorite. I mean, don't dream and drive. I love that scene. But yeah, don't dream and drive. That would be.
And that takes us to another part where you wrote some fantastic really gory and gruesome scenes.
Oh yeah.
For number five. And they were mostly pared down, like really watered down, especially like the motorcycle scene. How did you feel about that when you first
it's not like I didn't know that was coming, you know, and also, you know, when you write a script, even a script that's about to be made, you're trying to create there's a bit of it that's sort of like this is going to sound awful, and I don't mean it to sound the way it's about to sound, but it's a sales perspective. I mean, you're trying to make up for cinematography, acting, music, light, you know, so you're doing everything you can to convey the mood on a piece of paper that someone's going to get watching the movie. And sometimes that means, you know, you gruesome it up. I mean, having to eat your own entrails. I mean, that's just
It's so good.
You know, who knows how much they're going to let you do. But
the Greta scene, especially for me, like that scene is so hard hitting and so just so mean. It's just mean, and I love it.
It is mean. I remember distinctly writing that scene. It's a way I write that I haven't gotten over yet. I still do stuff like that.
Nice.
I guess I'm just a very mean person.
That's fun.
My favorite. I like the you know, Freddie is the talk show host.
Oh yeah, that's a great scene.
It was sort of the first like real flush of obnoxious talk radio.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think Rush Limbaugh already had a show, but you know, this is more like that. They were like dumb psychiatry shows, you know, right, and stuff like that, self-help shows. I did that in a horror show too. I did an entire parody of the Jerry Lewis telethon, you know, couldn't help myself.
Well, and it actually like takes like the Freddie is David Letterman to heart for a real.
It was a good note, you know. Like, I like that. I wish I still had that sheet because the rest of them were really. I don't remember any of the other rules, but there were like 50 rules.
Wow, you know, I wish you had that sheet too. That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
So, is there anything in the talk show scene that was in your original script that wasn't in the final cut of the movie?
That's a scene that it just took a lot longer.
Mm.
You know, it was agonizing. Like he's driving and you don't know if he's asleep or he's not asleep. And, you know, then he turns on the radio because he wants to keep himself awake. And then, you know, you slowly realize that the woman calling in is his mother. And then by the time you get to Freddie going, well, if I were you, I'd gut the little bastard. You know, I wish it was more agonizingly scary. You know, it's pretty close to what I wrote. It's just not as scary as you know, I imagine.
Definitely a cool sequence for sure. And I think it adds to that tension, you know, of the eventual, you know, crash and everything.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely does. When was the first time you actually saw The Dream Child?
I was recording in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, I went to see it the day it came out. I was like, oh, I'm in the theater. I think I'll go see it.
Oh, nice. What did
yeah,
you
it was
think?
Really fun. I loved it. I mean, it's like, you know, there's, I don't like to go to screenings. I like to go to the movies. If you've ever seen The Big Sleep, there's a moment where Humphrey Bogart's visiting the film model. He's visiting the gangster at his club, Eddie Mars, and he's in the office. Eddie Mars says, if you'd like, you can go out the back room. And Philip Marlowe goes, no thanks, I like to take my chances with suckers. And a screening's like you have no idea what real people are going to think.
Right.
Like this is like a crowded theater on a Saturday night. And people were booing and making noises. And I was like, you know, and I was just obscurely in the back. And it was really fun.
That's awesome. That's always such a great way to go, because then you don't have to, you know, you don't really have to talk to anybody about it. And, you know, you can have your thoughts all to yourself and just take in what you worked on. So I definitely agree that's the best way to do it.
Oh, it's great.
Is there any part in the Dream Child script that, you know, you really were jazzed about and you thought really like translated well in the movie.
It was fun to finally see the maniacs.
Yeah.
That just made us all, you know, because we'd heard Demon Spawn of 10,000 Maniacs for so many shows. So it was like, it'd be fun to actually see that. Fun is kind of an unpleasant way to put it. But, so that to me was fun. And I, even though, yes, it could have been gorier, the Greta thing is still, you know, horribly wonderful.
But that maniac scene is great too. Did you write in that Robert Englund, you know, had to be kind of noticeably in that moment?
Oh yeah. We were actually playing with them, and that's really fun.
Oh yeah, it's so funny because him, like the last, he's like, you know, you pan through all the people and then he's like the one that just turns around and you're like, oh no, oh shit, there he is.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Did you go through many rewrites on your own script for the Dream Child?
We were starting in a month, and then we were starting in 2 weeks, and then, you know.
Right, it was a quick, it was a really quick production.
Yeah, so, you know, as I said, I mean, I don't even remember if I'd done a draft of the newer version before Steve came on, or I think I was maybe halfway through, and then we just worked together. It was the way that stuff always is. You don't have enough time to get it right, nobody else has enough time to get along.
Yeah.
Kind of the benefits of the Mad Rush.
Did you ever visit the set? Were you ever present when they were shooting?
Yeah, I think I was there for part of the Greta.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you have any like initial thoughts on like, oh yeah, this is what I pictured when I wrote it?
No, not really. You know, it was more like, oh cool, I'm on a movie set. I guess I'd been on the set of the horror show a bunch, so you know, it wasn't like the first thing I'd written that. But you know, I mean, you sit there and they say your lines, you're like, wow, this is really cool, and then you sit there and they say the same lines again, and then you know, 6 hours later and they're still saying the same lines, you're like, okay,
right,
got it.
I've had enough. Yep. It must be really cool to see Robert Englund deliver the lines that you wrote for such an iconic character.
Yeah. Well, when people who work on television shows get it all the time where, you know, you're in a writer's room and you're working on somebody else's characters, but I'd never done that. So, it's like, wow, I get to figure out what Freddie's going to say, you know, like, you know, I'm such a huge Freddie fan. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I get to do this.
That is so cool. And you know, he has some of his most jokester lines, I think, in number five. And it just makes him, he's always been a likable villain. But in number five, you see yourself like rooting for him.
Well, certainly we feel bad for Anthony Perkins in Psycho, but we don't know he's crazy yet.
Right.
There, I just spoiled the movie for somebody.
Uh-oh, spoiler alert. Psycho, don't.
Yeah. Darth Vader's Luke's father, there.
Oh my gosh. Les, come on, our audience. You know, it's just a roller coaster of fun, The Dream Child. And I love it. I think it's so cool how just surreal they made that movie. You know, it really reminds me of like an Argento movie. You know, it's like the Freddy Argento. If Argento did a Freddy movie, that's what it would be.
That's high praise. I'd love to take all the credit. I think that's before Stephen Hawking.
Yes. Stephen did a really, really cool job with it, for sure.
Yeah.
Did you ever write any other pitches for the Nightmare franchise?
Only I worked with Sean Cunningham a lot, and they were always trying to do a Freddy Jason movie, which they finally did. And I was like, well, you have to wait until you've made 12 Nightmare movies so you can call it Freddy the 13th.
Oh.
So that was my only pitch.
That's a great one. If they can ever, you know, if someone can ever get it together, that's a good one.
It was like, I don't care how much you want to make this movie, you can't make it. There's 12 Nightmares. Nobody listen to me on that one.
It's a great idea. Hey, I'll keep holding out for that one. So.
Yeah, I would go see that movie no matter what it was.
Oh, yes. Count me in. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now and what you're excited about.
Oh, well, thank you, Brett. I put out an album last year. It's the first album I've done in like 30 years.
Wow.
Actually, my first solo album.
Congrats.
It's called Move to Duarte. Mm. It's up on all the usual platforms. And just this month, I have a novel, which is an Audible original, and John Waters reads it.
Oh, wow.
It's called Junk. There are some scenes that are reminiscent of the Greta scene.
Mm.
It's very unpleasant. It's somewhat sci-fi, somewhat horror, somewhat pretentious. and somewhat good, I think.
Oh, that's so cool. I can't wait to listen to that. And Les, I have one more question for you. And it's a question I ask all of our class of 89 graduates. What advice would you give yourself 30 years ago?
Take less shit.
I love it.
seriously, I've been a little too agreeable about some stuff over my career. And there are a few times I wish I'd stood my ground a little bit more forcefully.
Well, that's great advice, because I think everyone can relate to that. So,
yes, because we all have taken our share. I know.
Yes. Take less shit.
Take less shit. Oh, there you go. My three-word novel.
I love it. Well, Les, thank you so much for joining us today. That was a fascinating look behind the scenes of A Nightmare on Elm Street 5. The Dream Child. Very cool. Thank you so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Danny! Better not dream and drive!
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 89. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 89 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pacetta, executive producers Dallas Saunier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavimer, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pacetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Winardi, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.